In today's episode of Backpacker Radio, presented by The Trek, we are trying new things. In lieu of an interview, myself, alongside Chaunce and Sauce, that's Elise, cover some of the most common beginner backpacking mistakes. Because we here at Backpacker Radio can occasionally steer off topic, we wanted to experiment with an episode dedicated to what the show's title would imply, backpacking stuff. These pointers run the full spectrum from massive mistakes to minor gaffes. Regardless of where you are in your backpacking evolution, we think you'll walk away from this one with some very useful insight. But first, Organifi is a line of organic superfood blends that offer plant-based nutrition with high-quality ingredients. You've heard myself and the Real Hiking Viking talk about the importance of using a green superfood powder during our 100-day thru-hike of the PCT. Organifi chooses the highest quality plant-based ingredients for optimal health, with each blend using organic ingredients aimed at helping you feel and perform your best. The Organifi Green Juice includes 11 superfoods to serve as backpacking nutritional insurance while you're on the trail, because carrying vegetables on trail is somewhere at the intersection of rare and batshit crazy. Some of the ingredients in the green juice include moringa, ashwagandha, which is a supplement I love and use regularly to manage stress, chlorella, spirulina, and wheatgrass, just to name a few. In addition to the green powder, Organifi offers a slew of other healthy drink powders, including the red juice with beets, berries, and cordyceps, the Organifi Gold, which includes reishi mushroom, turmeric, and ginger, and Organifi Pure, which contains neurofactor, lion's mane, and baobab. The best part of all of these products is that they're perfect for backpacking, coming in individual single serving size packets that do not require refrigeration. Just rip it open, pour the packet into your water, shake, and feel amazing. It's that simple. Organifi's green juice and Pure have been staples every morning for me during my travels and acts as nutritional insurance when I'm otherwise eating like a raccoon. And it's especially important when I'm exerting myself day in and day out. Discount time. Backpacker Radio listeners, go to Organifi.com/backpacker to receive 20% off your order. That's Organifi, Organifi.com/backpacker, and use code backpacker at checkout for 20% off your purchase.
Zach and I are both big fans of Gossamer Gear, manufacturers of lightweight backpacking gear and accessories. Their packs carry comfortably, their roomy shelters protect in harsh weather conditions, and the trekking poles are some of the lightest on the planet. Gossamer Gear is changing the perception of delicate, ultralight gear. Zach and I are both users of Gossamer Gear's packs and shelters. I used Gossamer Gear's The One shelter on the John Muir Trail last August and plan to take it with me again on camping trips this summer. It's spacious, packs small, and if you didn't already know where this was headed, it's the one you need. Zach has used the Gorilla, their 40-liter pack, for more than 3,000 miles of backpacking, including his PCT thru-hike in 2017. Drink. He's a big proponent of the Gossamer Gear Light Flex Hiking Umbrella, which he used to protect his fragile ginger skin on the PCT and Trans-Catalina Trail. Good news, listeners of Backpacker Radio can score an exclusive deal on Gossamer Gear products. Use discount code GINGERSAREGOOD for 15% off your cart at gossamergear.com. Again, that's gingers, R, the word, not the letter, good, all one word, at gossamergear.com. Gingers are good. Don't sleep on this, as the deal is only valid for a limited time.
Welcome to Backpacker Radio, presented by The Trek. I am your co-host, Zach Badger Davis, and sitting to my right is...
Hi, I'm Juliana Chauncey, a.k.a. Chaunce.
And sitting to her right is...
Hi, I'm Elise, a.k.a. Sauce.
A third Sauce. Co-host.
Sauce.
Is that your trail name?
Yeah.
I've never known that.
I know. We've gone so off trail with her name. I've heard it before, but like I said just a second ago, my brain is Swiss cheese, so...
It's also been an evolution. It started out as SOS, and then it evolved to Sauce.
Oh, wait, no, I did know that. I was thinking Sauce, like S-A-U-C-E.
That's how I spell it now because it's easier. Cool. Maybe I shouldn't. I don't know.
I'm about that.
Is the sauce literally just a play on the fact that SOS kind of sounds like sauce?
If you say it a certain way. Uh-huh. Yeah. And we realized yelling SOS in the woods wasn't the best idea.
Very good point.
Fair. Yeah.
Very good point. The boy who cried wolf. Mm-hmm. Today, let's introduce why we have three co-hosts. As you might have guessed from the title of today's show, we're going with a little bit of a different format. Instead of an interview, we wanted to do a panel. And who better than our trusty production assistant, Elise, to join us for this conversation. The subject, we're going very low-hanging fruit, high-level, whatever you want to do there. We're going to cover the biggest backpacking mistakes, things that we see on the trail ourselves, things that we've encountered through Instagram. I have a fairly unique perspective doing what I do with the Trek, so we hope that there's a little bit of value in the knowledge that we can relay with you today. But before we get there, I think we have a strange question of the day.
Yes. So as you will remember, and you will remember, and the people who might have listened to the last episode with Viking about the Hey Duke could remember, is that we had a questions girls have about guys that they're too afraid to ask segment that started off mellow and then just turned into us talking about balls.
Yeah, I remember Jabba talking about his scrotum quite a bit.
Yes. So this weekend, balls came up.
As they do.
But like
in cold water.
It was boys talking to boys, and I was listening, like, I was next to the conversation, so I heard part of it, and I don't know how it got to this point. But essentially what I learned is that, okay, hold on, wait, I wrote it down. There's a couple of things I learned that I need input on. The left ball, no matter who it is, the left ball is lower, and your main childbearing ball, and your right one is your backup ball and is less important. So if you like injure or ruin your right ball, it's not as bad as if you injure or ruin your left ball, because your left ball holds most of the baby stuff and the right one is just like the spare.
Yeah, that is actually incredibly scientifically accurate.
Is that really right?
Yeah, that's so true.
I'm waiting for the like, haha.
Yeah, no, that's total bullshit. I mean, unless they know something that I don't know, but I took health courses
really,
also.
Like, they seemed really.
Oh, God.
Okay. It was like four guys, and they were all like, no, that's totally true.
Is the trick here that I'm just going to get the stranger's ads for the next 3 months because I'm Googling left ball,
right ball? I'm not smart enough to make
ball,
up a funny
right
ploy like this. I genuinely, I was like, okay, let me write this down. And I'm about to text them and say, I'm hearing the ball thing isn't true.
Okay. If you Google left testicle versus right testicle,
yes.
It is common for guys to have slightly different sized testicles. Usually the right testicle is larger than the left.
No, that's against what they wrote.
Okay. Also, one testicle, usually the left, often hangs lower than the other.
That one they said.
That honestly.
Oh, they didn't put size. Left ball is lower and main childbearing ball, and right one is backup ball, less important. Okay, so they didn't put size. So far, all accurate.
I thought that was total. I thought they were just.
What about main childbearing? Is it worse to lose your left?
The fact that they got that part right, I'm actually now switching my stance.
Am I teaching you about your body?
Apparently.
Okay, search, is it worse to lose your left testicle or your right testicle in like a tragic accident?
So I control F'd this article for child and there nothing came up, so let's see. Googling the child testicle.
You're Googling child testicles?
Ooh, that's bad.
Change it. Change it.
Okay. Now I'm getting the weird ads.
The police are coming to your house tonight.
Yeah. If I'm not at the next episode, that means I'm in prison for what I just said.
I can't believe you just Googled that. Wow.
Yikes.
Oh, man.
Okay. This one's going to take more sleuthing than I think we've got time.
Okay, well, I'm sure we've got a child testicle expert in
the fact that one hangs lower, maybe that's got to be
because
like,
it's heavier, there's more kids in it.
Wait, no, the one with more kids is up, they said.
No, the left ball typically hangs lower.
Yeah, but that article said that the right testicle was bigger typically,
but this doesn't comment on size. It just says left ball is lower and main childbearing ball,
but don't you think the bigger ball would be the one where all the kids are?
No. Hmm. It could be full of air. It could be full of secrets. It could be...
That's true.
Almost guess the one that's higher up would be more kids because it's more protected.
Mm.
Like evolution.
But maybe all the little spermies make it heavier so it hangs lower.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's possible.
Well, Well, that's,
yeah, 100% of the ball talk in my life is all just joking or like guys getting kicked in the ball videos, like American Funniest Home Video style is my interaction with balls.
Okay, yeah. Cool. Well, mine's all science-based.
I have a kid. I am an adult. reminders of any kind. I don't know if we've talked about going to Wisconsin yet, but
are we going there?
We are going to Wisconsin. What? We actually just wrapped a hopefully final touch meeting with our friends at the Ice Age Trail Association to complete our itinerary. What were the takeaways for you two? Not the band. You two.
Oh, got it. Not funny. We are going
to have so
much fun. It is chock full of stuff. We are going to be spending just as much time on trail as we are off trail. We are going to be having multiple meetups. We are going to be doing a live podcast episode, most likely. And we are going to be doing overnight hikes. We are going to be doing hikes in different parts of the state, eating fish fries, going to breweries.
We have a special guest for our live podcast. We'll leave it at that.
Somebody is going to come have our live podcast with us, and it is not something you want to miss.
Any other input, Elise?
I feel like I'll need to train my liver more than train for hiking.
Yeah, we have a little side text thread happening, and talking about the game day Saturday. I can see that Chance is, your own words, you
apprehensive,
were nervous, excited, and I think Elise is just more so nervous.
I'm nervous, excited.
You're nervous, excited, and Chance is excited, nervous.
I'm just too stubborn to not keep up, and I know the tangled web that weaves.
Yeah, well.
I know the person I was in college. And
I can't wait to meet her.
Yeah. Okay, let's get to the not interview for today's show. I guess it is an interview, the interview with the Cinnamon Connection, the Paprika Pals. Saffron Squad. Mm-hmm. There were some other good ones in there. It's been a minute since we put those out. Yeah. Get that
Stop
one.
Stop talking.
Also, Elise, she's not colored properly, but we won't hold it against her. As I mentioned previously, today's theme is going to be covering the biggest backpacking mistakes that we've encountered in one way or the other. Probably some of these things we've done ourselves. I know I've done some of these. As a bit of a preamble, I want to just state out the gate that not all these pieces of advice are going to apply to everyone, certainly not a one-size-fits-all. Also, there's going to be, I predict, quite a bit of overlap between our suggestions, so don't hold that against us. Backpacking is a pretty simple thing, although not an easy thing, and we'll get into that. Lastly, if you do enjoy the format for this type of show, let us know. We want to do what you like. And that includes, but is not limited to, having Jabba on the show. Okay. Mm-hmm. So the format is we're going to go around the table and say our things, introduce our things, and have a discussion about each one of these, if applicable. I'm going to go with the number one mistake. And I do think this is the thing that potentially the most people mess up on. At least people that get off trail quickly, I think this is the thing that they should be doing better. And that is, we're not plugging my book quite yet, not doing shakedown hikes. And this is something that actually goes against what I said in my book. I don't actually advocate for people to not do shakedown hikes, but I think I underplay the importance of it. And the more I've been exposed to this world, the more I think that shakedown hikes are maybe just shy of essential. I think you can do a through hike without a shakedown hike. I am a testament to that. I think Chance more or less is a testament to that. We can talk.
My first multi-day trip was the PCT.
That's what I'm saying. I think I'm advocating that you should do a shakedown hike.
Oh, yeah. No,
but you can do the trail without a shakedown hike.
Got it. I thought you were saying I did them.
No.
No, I was in a lot of pain in the beginning instead of doing them.
And I know a number of examples similar to us where the first backpacking trip is like, okay, I'm going to go do the whole thing. But I think that is a mistake. If you don't want to be the person who like flips their life upside down, quits their job, sells their house, eats their dog, whatever that might entail, I think you should get out and actually kick the tires a little bit. And maybe we should define what a shakedown hike. Mm-hmm. Very simple, literally just a practice hike. Getting out where you can, ideally in conditions that are as similar for the bigger thing that you're doing, but whatever you can do is a lot better than nothing. And this is important for quite a number of reasons. I think One of the biggest ones, obviously, is testing out your gear when you're going out on the trail and you have only set up your tent in your backyard or like worn your rain jacket in the shower for 5 minutes. You don't actually know your gear at all. You have to set it up in a variety of conditions. You have to have done it while you're tired, dirty, all the conditions that go into an actual backpacking trip. You're not going to recreate unless you're on a backpacking trip. I also think it's important to put yourself into conditions where you're practicing in inclement weather. And I'm sure Chance has got a story for this, mm-hmm. but you don't actually know what you're getting into, especially if you're going out into a trail like the AT where it's going to rain on you. You're going to get wet a lot. And if you discover about yourself pretty early on that you don't like hiking when it's wet, you're going to have a bad time. So I think going out in the conditions where it is the most miserable where you are is the best way to prepare for this with limited time. I had another piece I wanted to mention about that. And maybe it'll come to me, but maybe not.
One of mine, my second one is going to piggyback yours. Sure. So maybe it'll come to you by then.
Sure. And then the last thing that I think is important about a shakedown hike is I think obviously like the physical component of a shakedown hike, like stacking multiple days, I think is really important. Just because you can do one 20-mile day doesn't mean you can do 20 miles 3 days in a row. The exhaustion compounds itself. So you're going to wake up weaker on day two and then weaker on day three. And like, that's when injuries really start to happen. So knowing how to pace yourself for multiple days is something that you're going to learn during a shakedown hike. I also think a shakedown hike is good mental preparation. I think if you're not used to being by yourself or whatever the condition might be, being on trail, it's one thing to go for a day hike. The mental perception of the experience of a day hike is radically different from a backpacking trip. And I think Chaunce's general disdain for day hiking is a testament for this, because she loves backpacking and is not a big fan of day hiking.
I used to love day hiking. I used to go on a day hike every Saturday and Sunday when I first moved here. It's just now that I've gone on longer hikes and I see that you can like sleep in between your day hikes, it doesn't make sense for the driving.
Yeah. Agreed.
I just like it less.
Yeah. So I think that's my basic outline for why I think a shakedown hike is important. And again, I'm getting greedy taking this one because it is such a big thing. We could probably talk about the importance of a shakedown hike for an entire episode. But for me, those are the biggest points. And if you're seriously considering a thru hike, you can thru hike without a shakedown hike, but you're putting yourself in a way better position for success by actually getting out on some practice hikes.
Yeah, and I'm not going to go into my second point yet because I do know that it's going to be echoing part of the shakedown idea, but I don't really consider what I'm going to get into as a shakedown. And I think this goes into yours, is that like a lot of people will think, okay, I've done my shakedown hike, I know what gear I'm carrying. Because you think of a shakedown hike in terms of shaking down the extra stuff you don't need, tuning in your gear, that sort of thing. But like, there's so much more that goes into it than just knowing what you're going to carry. And I think just even the term shakedown hike just implies you just need to sort out your gear, when really there's so much more than that to sort out on it.
Great point. Lisa, have you anything you want to add to the shakedown? Did you do a shakedown before the PCT?
I did single overnights. I never did more than one, which, like you said, I don't necessarily advise. But I think one big thing that helped a lot was I was alone for those and like didn't even run into other backpackers. So I learned like I could actually sleep out in the woods alone and be okay. And I think that gave me a lot of confidence going into the PCT.
Yeah, that is a great point. I think.
Don't touch on it too much.
Okay. Well, yeah. Like I said, I took a very big subject. So to Chance's request, I'll just leave it at that.
Yes. Okay. So this isn't that. So we'll get back to that. This one, maybe I'll just put them in different orders. I'm going to put them in different orders. Okay. My next one is... kind of a piggyback on the shakedown hike, but in terms of preparing mentally instead of preparing physically. So kind of right where Zach just left off. And that's like suggesting to take practice hikes overnight with your phone on airplane mode or turned off the entire time. You know, like Elise said, going on a hike and being alone and, you know, sleeping in her tent alone and having that alone factor helped her prepare for the PCT. But like, you aren't even alone if you're alone and your phone's going off and you could text someone or you can call someone before you can go to bed. There's a lot of times on trail where you're not going to have service. And like, not even when you're happy and you're not having service. Like, you could be struggling and frustrated and feeling down, and, like, you can't get on to talk to someone, at least not consistently. If you have an inReach or something like that, you could send a message. But I think it's important for people to practice being out there for more than just an afternoon without being connected, and seeing, you know, how far do you get before it's just like, man, I just want to check one thing, or, like, I just want to see if I got any messages, you know, and just push yourself to have that mental break from your technology, because you're going to be forced to have it on most trails at least once, yeah, if not the full time.
And if you've got AT&T and you're hiking the AT, definitely practice not having cell service for multiple nights in a row, unless things have changed, which is very likely. But I remember the southern half of the AT, cell service was very spotty for AT&T. Mm-hmm. But I think that is an excellent point. I think my generation's weird in that, like, I came of age kind of when the internet was happening. I think I remember first going on the internet when I was 15 years old, but a lot of hikers that are, you know, 15 years younger than me can't even remember a time without the internet, mm-hmm, and just constantly are plugged in. And then, to Chauncey's point, when you get to a point where you don't have that access, and I'm going to say crutch, but crutch is not the right word. It's just it's an input. It's a stimulus that you've grown accustomed to. And when you don't have that, I think it can bring about a sense of anxiety, because it's your inlet to the rest of the world. And all of a sudden you're just by yourself in the woods. I think practicing for that is an excellent piece of advice.
Yeah. I mean, it definitely makes places feel more remote. Like, you could be equally as far out there in two separate scenarios. And in one of them, your phone could be vibrating as you're getting texts. And in the other one, you can't get reception to save your life. And they're going to be different experiences for you. And I think if you're practicing within cell reception and you aren't taking steps like turning your phone off, you're not going to be getting the full experience of what you might face on trail.
Yeah. The wilderness purists are going to kick me in the teeth for saying this one, but I just sleep. I fall asleep much better if I've got something to listen to. So, to Chauncey's point, download a couple podcasts. Probably not this one. This one's terrible. But download something. If you're like me and you like to listen to something as you're snoozing off, because you cannot rely on cell service on trail. It's nice to have an audiobook or whatever, yeah, it might be.
I do and don't like falling asleep to things. I like falling asleep to things because then I can't hear whatever animal I think is going to come kill me. But I don't like falling asleep to it because I'll eventually wake up in the night from the sound of it, like in my earbud, in my ear. So I like to make playlists that are like either 30 minutes long or an hour long or 15 minutes long. So if I'm tired and I'm getting into my bed and I just want to plug in to have that peace of mind to just fall asleep, I know whatever I put on is going to get me there, and then it'll just turn off.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is nice.
Another pro tip, at least the Apple Podcast app, I'm guessing Spotify has this too, has like a sleep function.
Does it?
Yeah, yeah.
I have the Apple Podcast app.
Yeah, so you can push like go to sleep in 30 minutes. Yeah.
No way.
Way.
I'll look at that later.
But to Chauncey's point, like if the thought of like a bear attack is going to keep you awake at night, maybe just download an app that has white noise that is just the constant sound of a bear attack. That way, like, you grow accustomed to it before it actually happens to you.
You could download YouTube audio of bear attacks.
Yeah, totally.
And then you're already listening to it. Any kind of like
vicious murder will work.
Right.
But like, just white noise, background, some soothing stuff to get you to slumber.
If you fall asleep to the sound of leaves crunching to animal feet in your earbuds,
just snarling,
then that won't sound as scary outside your tent because you'll think it's in your ears.
Yeah, the sound of play the sound of something scraping against your tent.
Yes,
heavy breathing.
There you go.
Okay, we're on to something here. Great advice, guys. Elise, your turn.
Okay, so mine, I think I'd like to think is a little unique. Well, I think there's a slew of mistakes you can make with water. Just filtering water for the first time was a huge unknown for me. I'd never had to do that. I don't think most people have ever had to do that.
I googled how to filter water when I got my Sawyer.
Yeah.
Before the PCT, I watched a YouTube video on how to do it.
This was before the PCT?
Yeah.
Okay, at least you didn't do it on trail. That'd be worse.
Well, after the PCT, when I was like, what kind of videos can I make? Like, it felt almost stupid to make one on how to filter water, because I was like, you screw it on and you turn it upside down. But before the trail, I had no idea, and I was just looking at it, and I was like, I hope I don't do this wrong. Like, watch the YouTube video, and it was like, screw it on, turn it upside down.
Yeah. Well, and I think there is stuff that you can mess up if you're not really thinking about it. Like, I think the first time someone told me that all it takes is a drop you can't even see of Giardia in your water to make you extremely sick really sent me spiraling. So knowing to keep your dirty water bottle for sure separate, I think, is a big thing. I think I've been talking to a lot of people who are getting into backpacking and like emphasizing to them, you can't just eventually filter water into that bottle. Like once you put dirty water in it, it's done. Mm-hmm. And then something that I learned from another thru hiker on the PCT, my Sawyer just wasn't filtering normally. Like it kept dribbling out the sides and all this weird stuff was happening. And it's because if you screw it too tight.
Yeah, O-ring.
Yeah, it messes up the O-ring and it doesn't, for whatever reason, it doesn't go straight through. And I feel like that's a little known thing that you just want to tighten it just enough.
And tip. Then,
yeah.
So the O-ring, like, it'll come off, like, how it's held in, and then it's not, like, in right, which it makes it leak, so then you always have to take it out and put it in again. But if you go to, like, a hardware store, you can get, like, a rubber washer that's a little bit thicker than the O-ring in width, and if you put that in, it never falls out. Mm. So if you lose your O-ring, like, you're not screwed forever. Or if you just, like, are prepping for a trail and you don't want to worry about your O-ring, go to a hardware store and show them it and say, hey, do you have, like, a rubber one of this, like, a little thicker? And they'll know exactly what to give you. And I've gotten them on trail when I've lost mine. I've gotten them before trail, and it's great.
Yeah. Put it in, I'll carry one in my, like, repair kit, basically. And you can also, I've heard people super glue their O-rings into their Sawyers. I don't know if that permanently does anything, but
I wonder why Sawyer wouldn't do that themselves. Like, is there an advantage to have it? I guess, like, if it cracks or something, but
I know
I actually haven't had that issue with the Sawyer, but I've had that issue with other O-ring products in the past. And is it just a matter of, like, one side of it gets rotated so it won't sit flush when you screw it in?
Or it gets pushed in. Like, so if you screw it in too far to the water bottle, I'm going to have to figure out how to show this. If you screw it in too far to the water bottle, what happens to the O-ring is it gets pushed by the water bottle, so it, like, sinks into it. Mm-hmm. So it's not sitting there flat.
So water
it's
gets, like, in that
pushed
indentation.
In, and then that leaves out room for it to go in.
Got it.
So it just messes. Because, like, if you take it off, you'll see that it's usually stuck in your water bottle. Uh-huh. And it's because it gets, like, suctioned in from you turning it too tight in there.
Got it.
And then it, yeah, it doesn't work well.
It's a good tip. Mine was, like, so... big picture. That's a much more minute thing. I love that.
I just remember it changed my life when that person told me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And also I was carrying, this is part of this, I was carrying a mini. And so it was already taking me ages to filter water. And that on top of it all, half of it basically coming out of the water bottle, it was just a nightmare every time. So.
Here's another tip. Don't carry the mini.
Yeah. That's what I was going to say.
I didn't even read it. I'm sorry.
No.
It's their third bullet point.
It's part of the water mistakes series that I made. And then also, yeah, the mini is like an ounce lighter, not at all worth it for context, for those that don't know. And then for getting to back flush and not testing your water filter before you leave, I did this like last in May. When I went to do a segment of the Colorado Trail, Josh, my boyfriend, and I both forgot to back flush. So we both had water filters that were trickling, and it was rough.
Yeah, the back flush is an important one. Because I think, in general, people are pretty lazy with maintenance stuff. Mm-hmm. Like, I am. I'm not going to point fingers. But I've learned the importance of not back flushing the Sawyer through firsthand experience. I guess that's redundant. So that's, certainly a thing you want to do. The Sawyer comes with a syringe. I know you can also use a particular smart water bottle cap that'll actually do the trick, so you don't have to carry anything extra with you.
It's the nice cap. It's the flippy
sport
top.
Sport cap.
Flippy top.
Yeah, the 750 milliliter.
Highly coveted among thru hikers.
Yes. Mm. Yeah, you get to a gas station with that, and it's going to fly off the shelf. So if you're a gas station owner and you're listening to this, that's your ticket. Anything else you wanted to cover with the water mistakes?
Don't drink straight out of streams unless you're above maybe like 11,000 feet.
Yeah.
Or higher.
And even then, like...
Even then, it's risky. There's marmots that
marmots,
live up there.
Exactly, yeah. I think I read something like per capita, Colorado has the highest Giardia instance.
Oh, neat.
I think people assume stuff like that. Like, everything looks so pristine. I can drink this water. And then, you're shitting your guts out.
Yeah. Dogs can get Giardia, too, which I didn't know.
Whoa, can they?
Mm-hmm.
My sister's dog just got Giardia. So, there you
neat.
Go. Yeah, there it is.
Well, I suppose you're not just going to be, like, filtering your dog's water. That would be crazy.
No. Yeah, I think that's just the dice you got to roll with the dog.
Yeah.
Another fun fact, apparently Giardia is very transmissible from one dog to the next.
Uh-huh. Yeah, they get it at dog parks a
lot.
Can
you get Giardia from your dog if your dog's like licking you?
I can say this for certain. My sister's dog had Giardia and was still somewhat sick. I think it was toward the end of the antibiotic treatment. And then as the dog was licking me in the mouth, she let me know that the dog had Giardia currently. So I was a little bit upset about that situation. But happy to say that my poos have been pretty solid. You know, pretty. Like, you have a couple Taco Bells, things change. But I've been okay.
Okay.
Can't even think of the last time I've actually had Taco Bell.
I saw it on the way here and I considered.
But then you take that route through like the roundabout over in South Golden?
The a million roundabouts?
Yes.
Yeah. Colorado loves
roundabouts. I had police cars following me from those roundabouts all the way to the bank. And I was like, I'm going to get pulled over for something and I don't know what.
It's like you were getting escorted to the Taco Bell.
It really stressed me out.
Okay.
I always get nervous my driving's not going to be good enough.
We're not even pulling you over for speeding. It's just, it's not good enough.
Yeah. You're just not good enough and we wanted to let you know.
Mistake number four. This one I've got a little bit written down here.
Yeah, what am I going to say?
But this is something that I have learned from witnessing others. I didn't make this mistake myself because I didn't buy anything that was advanced. So let me first introduce it before I get too far ahead of myself. That is buying gear beyond your skill set / experience. I think sometimes people refer to it as skill set when really it's just like you haven't built a comfort using this stuff. Not necessarily a skill set, but I think they go hand in hand. And I want to preface this by saying the same thing that I said at the top of this show, segment, whatever you want to call it, that there's going to be a lot of exceptions to this. I know plenty of people that have started the trail with the best UL gear, technical stuff, and you know they hit the ground running. They will go out and do a calendar year triple on their first through hike. Like, there's always obviously outliers, and I'm not speaking to them. I think for the majority of people, what I'm going to say is what I would advise. So, like I said, the more I've interacted with first-time hikers, I've seen a lot of people sending home their $600 brand-new UL DCF, Dyneema Cuban Fiber. No.
Dyneema Cuban Fiber.
Cuban Fiber.
Yeah, that's right.
Carbon fiber is like the bike stuff.
Composite fabric.
Composite.
Oh, yeah.
That's what it is. It used to be. So it used to be called Cuban fiber, and then they rebranded it. So it's a Dyneema composite fabric.
Oh, because they don't always use Cuban fiber.
I think it's the same material, but like a different company bought it, and so like we're gonna call it a different thing.
Neat.
But keep the acronym.
Yeah, exactly. So DCF. A lot of people will send home this very expensive tent, and the deal with that is, you can't go and test these things out at REI and then take it back if you don't like it. Like, these are from cottage industry brands and they don't have the return policy because these things are in such high demand. And, you know, if you're going to go out and use it once, like, it's very hard for them to resell it. So a lot of instances of people sending home these very expensive tents and then going out to REI and buying the $300 Big Agnes, Nemo, whatever the popular tent of the year is. I've seen that happen dozens of times, and I've learned that it's better to err on the side of that versus the alternative. So I generally push for first-time backpackers in the direction of getting freestanding tents. Like I said, I'm sure there are countless examples of first-time through hikers who hit the trail with the Z-Pax duplex and love every single night under their tents. But I would rather people err on the side of carrying a few extra ounces and be comfortable with the setup in a variety of terrains and to confidently set it up quickly in inclement weather conditions and ultimately getting the more pro-level tent later on in their backpacking careers. So this is the exact trajectory that I followed. The first tent that I got, it was the Eureka something bad. It was a one-person tent. It was not good. It was overweight. It was like 4.5 pounds. I wouldn't recommend that tent for anybody, but that style tent, a freestanding tent, something on the lighter end, is what I would generally push people in the direction of. But I was happy to have a tent that somebody as dumb as me could figure out how to set up. Like, the first time I tried to set it up, I did it successfully. And that, I'm not an engineering mind type of person. Like, I don't get these things right on the first try normally. And I think having the confidence of knowing how to set it up in pretty much any condition relieved the stress of the nighttime camp setup routine. Whereas if I went out with not to throw anyone under the bus, but like a Hyperlite Mountain Gear, I forget what their trekking pole tent is. I've used it in the past. It's a tricky setup. Like, even for me, somebody that's spent a lot of nights under a trekking pole tent setup in my career, I think doing that on a first long distance backpacking trip not doing it in a variety of conditions and a variety of terrains and in a variety of weather patterns, that would just add stress to my night. And whether that forces me off trail or it nudges me in the direction of not enjoying the experience, I don't think it's worth the weight savings. I would rather you cut down your mileage and be confident and comfortable with your tent setup than try to mimic the people out there that have got like 10-pound base weights. Like, that's something that you can achieve later in your backpacking career, and I don't think that's the thing that you should start off with. Again, I want to clarify that I'm not knocking trekking pole tents. Like, I used one the entire duration of the PCT. I loved how light it was. It was the right tent for that condition with my experience. But for first-time backpackers, people that are new to the game, I think you should get like a Big Agnes or a Nemo. It's just so much easier.
I will say, I had a friend who had a tarp tent on the PCT, and it was even more complicated. I had a duplex, and I did take out the duplex for the first time on the PCT, and I loved it. So, to your point, I think, but I also had a Big Agnes before that and got really comfortable with that. And so I think it was kind of a progression. But anyway, my friend that had the tarp tent, it was even more difficult, like, because there were so many guy lines and it was only one trekking pole, and she would not even set up her tent when it was drizzling sometimes because she just, it was such a pain for her. And yeah, so I think, sure, she was carrying probably like 4 or 5 less ounces than I was, but she also never slept in her tent. So.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I would say like same thing happened on the PCT where ball flap started. And I always forget this. Ball flap started with a bivy. And I always forget, but I remember when we got through Fuller Ridge, it rained at the top of that 19-mile downhill to Cabazon, and it was just rocks. Like, there was nowhere to set up a bivy the way that he had to set it up or however it needed to be set up. And it was just, like, us all in our tents, like, having a laugh at him while he was just, like, out there struggling. And, like, he got to town, and he switched it for a Fly Creek. Mm-hmm. And he carried a Fly Creek the rest of the way, a freestanding tent, but he was one of those people that wanted to start off super light, and then he found scenarios where in the desert it was like he couldn't even set it up.
Yeah. And I guess you bring up another good point is like the trekking pole tent is even easier to set up than most of the tarps and some of the bivy setups out there. Like, mm-hmm. there are people that go into their first through hike because they see such and such on YouTube that with their 6-pound base weight, and they're like, oh, this looks awesome. I want a super light pack. And like, they don't know how to set up their tarp. And then they get into a lightning storm. They have the worst night of their life. And they're like, do I actually like backpacking? Like, I don't want you to be that person. That said, I do have a lot of experience working with trekking pole tents. I've used the 1, the 2, and I used, it was called the Soulplex at the time. I don't
the
even know.
The 2 is a palace.
Yeah.
That thing is rooms.
It's a big, big, big tent. Yeah. And I love those tents and I use them regularly, but, I still use I have a couple of freestanding tents that I use them just as often. Like, if I'm going into a situation where I think the terrain's going to be very rocky, finding a place to stake out your tent properly is a motherfucker. I think if you're going out into conditions where it's going to be consistently windy, if you don't stake it out perfectly, you get a little bit of slack in your tent. That can keep you up all night because you hear the flapping all night. Like, that happened to me on the PCT a couple times. So even with a good skill set and experience that I would like to think that I have at this point, there's a lot of advantages to the freestanding tents that are just not the case with some of these other tents.
Yeah, there's also the single wall factor with a lot of the trekking pole tents, which if you don't ventilate your tent, you'll get a lot of condensation, you'll get wet, and you'll be cold.
For sure.
It has taken me 3 trails, and I still do not not that I don't know how to ventilate my tent, but there's just so many different conditions you can set up your tent in, near a pond, in a humid area, like on a ridge, you know, like under the tree line, above the tree line, where it's just like to master how to not get that humidity and the condensation build up in a single wall tent where like it's not dripping on your head is not something you figure out like overnight. Yeah. And if you do, tell me exactly how in all those scenarios, because I'm still at times getting water dripping on my head.
I mean, if you don't get the right campsite, you're pretty much just, and like it's very humid out. There are times where it's just, it doesn't matter what you're in. Yeah. You're going to get condensation.
And that's like something people don't expect with those kinds of tents,
sure,
I think.
For sure. I mean, that's even true for double wall tents. Like if you're in a humid area and like, especially if you're locking down the outer layer of the tent, it's just going to happen.
If you've done any amount of research on which gear is best for long distance backpacking, you are already familiar with our next sponsor. Enlighten Equipment specializes in manufacturing ultralight and minimalist gear that performs. From quilts and 8-ounce synthetic jackets to ultralight rain gear and wind pants, Enlighten Equipment offers a wide range of gear and apparel suited for anything the trail can throw your way. Based in the rolling bluffs of Winona, Minnesota, say that 5 times fast, Enlighten Equipment is a tried and true ultralight favorite for triple crowners, weekend warriors, and everyone in between. The name Enlighten Equipment is probably already familiar to you because it's been cited as the most used brand of sleeping bag or quilt from our most recent AT Thru-Hiker survey. Its popularity is not just confined to the Appalachians, as it's a thru-hiker favorite across all trails. They make a top-quality product at a very fair price. I've used an Enlighten Equipment quilt for many years and can personally attest that it's kept me warm on cold nights while keeping my pack load light. Now, this is the part you have been waiting for. Our friends at Enlighten Equipment are offering listeners of Backpacker Radio the rare 10% discount off Enlighten Equipment's best-selling stock Revelation quilt or tour jacket by using code TREK10 at checkout. That's TREK plus the number 10, no spaces, at checkout at enlightenequipment.com. This is a limited time code, so if you're in the market for a quilt and or synthetic jacket, do not sleep on this deal.
Okay, that was it. I feel like I talked in circles enough there.
That was a long one.
Chance goes.
Okay, mine is to do with, like, I guess being too firm on your hike and, like, not allowing flexibility for elements. I know you talked about on Shakedown Hikes practicing in the weather you're expecting, but I think just, like, knowing what kind of trail you're going on, like, what kind of trail are you starting on and what kind of weather is there and what are you, like, what are you doing to help yourself in those scenarios? And what I mean is, like, for example, the Colorado Trail compared to the AT. Like, the AT, you can wake up at 6 a.m. and hike till 5 p.m., or you can wake up at 8 a.m. and hike till 5 p.m. and get a full day in, morning to night, and that be it. Whereas on the Colorado Trail, like, you could get these afternoon storms that come in and just, like, pound down for hours in the afternoon and then clear up in the evening or clear up in the morning. And I think to go into a trail like the Colorado Trail and expect to hike an 8 to 5 the way you would on the AT is going to make it a lot more unpleasant for you than if you were to say, okay, I'm hiking, it's 2, I see clouds coming, I'm going to set up my tent, sit in my tent for an hour and a half while it rains, pack up my tent, hike another 3 hours. Like, a lot of people don't want to do that. And I think, you know, then you end up cold, you end up wet, you end up, like, struggling to get to camp. And I think just keeping mindful of what trail you're on, what elements you're going to be seeing, and what that requires for hiking. You know, you're going into the Sierra in the early season, you're hiking from like 3 a.m. to noon to avoid like sun holes or what are they, the post holing.
Sun cups and post holing.
So like depending on where you are, what time of year it is, what trail you're on, like you might not get the 8 to 5 hike. And by expecting that you will be hiking those standard hours throughout the day, you could start off, like, kind of screwing yourself because you might hike through weather that you don't have to if you had planned your day around it or anything like that.
Yeah.
To piggyback that would be, like, being too firm on your start date. Mm. So when I started the AT, the day I was supposed to start, the weather was supposed to be absolutely shit. And Josh, the guy that was hosting me, messaged me the day before my flight and was like, you don't want to start that day. And I really did not want to switch my day. It was going to be March 3rd, 3-3. I liked the number. And I was like, no, I think I'm going to hike that day. And he was like, no, like, you really don't want to. And, like, eventually talked me out of it. It was a few phone calls where he talked me out of it, and I decided I'd hike the next day. And the amount of people that got off that first day because of the weather was crazy. And that came back up for me this weekend. This was the story Zach foreshadowed. I had a friend come and stay with me who was going to start the Colorado Trail, and they started on Sunday. And it was just a horrible day for weather. And it was a combination of, I think, those two things amongst some other things. But going on a day where it was just forecasted to thunderstorm all day and having that be your first day on trail and getting a taste for the trail, the pain, the remoteness, the weather, and being cold and wet and everything, like, it was not a great first day to start, and it wasn't like typical hiking hours that would have gotten you through that day well. And they ended up getting off trail that night, and it was just like, I've never had that experience of having to try to talk someone out of quitting that soon, because I was like, I don't want you to feel like I'm not going to come get you, and I don't want you to feel like I'm not supporting you in this, and I don't want you to feel like I'm leaving you out there, but I also don't want you to regret it and, like, not have given it a fair shot and this and that. And I think it was just, like, not being mentally prepped for what the elements could do and how hard they could hit, and all of it combined with all the things we're saying, that I think just, like, completely just, like, it was a real shit day to start.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
Question, did you talk to this person since they've gotten off trail? Like, do they feel confident with their decision to get off, or are they like, mm-hmm. shit, maybe I should have given it more of a shot?
No, so they stayed with me the past few days. They just left this morning. I offered to give them a few days to stay, and then I said, if you want to get back on, I'll drive you back to where I left you off. But I think the consensus was just, you know, they weren't in the right headspace.
Yeah. It's good to recognize that. I think it's good to be honest with yourself about those things.
This whole week I've been wondering, like, in my head, I'm like, if the weather was sunny on Sunday, if the weather was sunny, it was dry, it was a moderate temperature, like, would they still be on the trail? And I don't know the answer to that, but I do think there is something to say for not expecting to hike traditional hours and not being too firm on your start date, that you're putting yourself in a scenario where you could ruin the whole thing for yourself.
For all of the backpacking trips that I can at least recall right this second, the first day on trail is always one of the most joyous days, because mm-hmm. it's like all the anticipation and nerves and whatever amount of energy coalesces into this thing where, like, you get out and you're doing the thing and you realize that you're just walking. Like, mm-hmm. you build it up to be this really difficult thing, and then you're out there walking, and it's just excitement for what's to come. Like, that's always been my experience. Yeah, I think to get out and have it be thunderstorming and to rob you of that experience is definitely makes it way more challenging.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's hard to be like, oh my God, I can't wait for the next day, I'm looking forward for what's to come, when you're just like, how the hell did I even make it through today? How am I supposed to do this for however many more days are supposed to be left, you know? And then you just start making it feel longer than it's going to be, and then you start to spiral in your head, I think. Like, whenever you start to think about how much is left and how long it's going to take, and is it going to be like this the whole time? And I think just setting yourself up so that you can start gently, be it in miles, be it in weather, be it in anything, a nice gentle start is the way to go.
Yeah, the spiraling is the worst thing. Like, once you get in your head and you don't have tools for breaking that circuit, true for backpacking or anything, apply that to anything in life. I mean, we've all experienced it. I still experience it to this day. But yeah, I think the spiraling is a really dangerous thing, and a thunderstorm is probably more likely to get you there than other conditions.
Yeah. I mean, it was hailing. It was not great.
Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like it's also worth noting that thunderstorms in Colorado,
completely different.
They entail hail, a lightning of tree line. It can be really scary and
cracking,
literally painful. Yeah.
It totaled my car 3 years ago. So yeah, it is a real thing. That is a very real
and
thing.
And yeah, to that point, I feel like, well, we'll probably get into this one of the points, but like knowing the variable weather wherever you're going, like that was something I had to learn when I first moved to Colorado, was if I want to go on a hike, I literally have to leave early if I'm going to be above tree line. Otherwise, I won't make it back down in time before the thunderstorms start.
Well, also, even just hiking the Colorado Trail on the weekends when I was sectioning it, I have like 5 different weather apps on my phone now in a folder that I never had before that hike. And it wasn't until during that hike that I realized I need all these different ways to check the weather, so that if I see that cloud over there, I can open my phone and I can say, okay, it's going to be here in this long. I have 20 minutes to either get over that ridge or pitch my tent. And unless you have stuff like that where you can check and make those assessments, or you have the skills to do it on your own, it makes it really difficult. So it's just like, if I had those maps at the start of my hike, it would have made the start easier. Towards the end, it was easier because I then knew to have them. But yeah, definitely prepping for the weather you need to expect.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think within that, you also just have to be prepared for anything. So I'm guilty of giving bad advice just based on my anecdote. It wasn't climate information. It was just like, this is what happened to me, so I think this is what it is. But Job and I did 300 miles of the Colorado Trail, I don't know how many years ago, and we saw rain for like 30 minutes. This was in September, so like traditionally I think that there's a lot less monsoon season at that point in the year, but we saw like almost no rain. And I encouraged somebody to go hike in September. I can't even remember who this was, honestly. But I remember that the hand that they got dealt was like, third day on trail, snow. Like, that's just how it goes. So don't listen to just me. Don't listen to just influencer on YouTube. Don't even necessarily put all your stake into like what the climate says historically, because that can change. I think back to the original point is be ready for anything and like use the historical trends as kind of the guiding point, but it can deviate from there and you just got to be prepared.
And be flexible.
Yeah.
Don't be too firm in what you're doing that you're not willing to modify.
Yeah.
That kind of really transitions perfectly into my next one, which is don't get gear just because someone else had it or they recommended it to you or your favorite YouTuber uses it. I mean, I've been guilty of that, but I feel like it really comes down to researching what you specifically need for like your size, your trail that you're hiking, the time period that you're hiking it. And that varies a lot more than you might think. Mm-hmm. It also varies. Are you a cold sleeper? Like I have a 5-degree bag. A lot of people would consider that super overkill. I still got really cold in Washington on the PCT.
Mm. What were the temperatures?
It was like in the 30s. Well, we were too late. That's another one of my points that I'm going to make. It's listen to people when they tell you to finish by October.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was in the, like below 30. The water sources were freezing, so
yikes.
It was cold. But still, it was a 5-degree bag, and I was having trouble staying warm. So, so I think really it's great to get opinions from other people, but at the same time, take it with a grain of salt, especially like, for example, Chance, a sleeping bag that works for you is not going to work for Zach. Mm-hmm. Or it even makes a difference if you're a stomach sleeper versus a side sleeper. I think they say to add like 6 inches to your sleeping
and that
height.
Goes for sleep. Then you get into sleeping pads.
Yeah.
You know, if you're a stomach sleeper versus side sleeper, different sleeping pads work mm-hmm. and don't. Shoes. Like anyone who is always at, like anyone who asks what shoes I recommend, I'm always like, I don't even want to answer this because like, I know the shoes I wear and I can't compare them to all the other options out there because I haven't tried all the other options and I don't know your feet. I only know my feet. And my
footwear is the hardest.
My best advice for people with, when they ask about shoes, I'm like, first of all, decide if you want boots or trail runners. I know that almost all through hikes, you're going to want trail runners. I feel like it's the general consensus, but some people do need boots because they actually have weak ankles and they're doing like 5-mile hikes. And,
ankles couldn't support me.
Yeah, second chance that he switched to ultras and they fucked up his feet and he went back to boots and was having a good time. So
So it's different for everyone. But also, best advice I ever got was go to a running store and have them fit you because they'll look at, do you pronate or do you supinate? Do you take weirdly short strides or whatever? And then they'll recommend a shoe for you based on that, and that's going to be what serves you best, not what some random person wears that you might respect. But
if you've got the privilege of living next to one of those stores, I totally agree with that. Yeah, they put you on a treadmill and make you run and then like slow motion evaluate your stride and can make some very intelligent recommendations based on that. Footwear is especially difficult. And for a lot of people, I think just like starting with ultra is a good piece of advice because it works for so many people. But like for some people, it gives them injuries. So like it can go in any direction.
Right. I mean, it goes for any piece of, it's stupid because this is the advice episode. So we're just giving advice. But with any piece of advice, there are so many ways where it's like what applies to me might not apply to you. And it could be a sleeping bag, a sleeping pad, shoes. But like I've had people even ask like, what do you carry for hygiene? And I'm like, dude, like, if you carry what I carry for hygiene, you might not like it at all because what I carry is not a lot because I like...
Just Axe body spray, is that all you carry?
I carry wet wipes and I carry a brush.
Yeah, same.
And like the wet wipes do anything that needs cleaning and the brush takes out the tangles. But like a lot of people can't do just that. And if you want to replicate that, but you're someone that really needs to like wash your face at night or put on moisturizer before bed or like has a routine that just makes you feel a little more at peace before you go to sleep, I can't relate to that, but you're certainly not gonna have a good time taking what I'm taking.
Yeah, that said, the advice I give to like my close friends is very different than the advice I give to people in other contexts. I did a backpacking trip on the Oregon Coast Trail a couple of years ago and my buddy was trying to bring like a little travel size thing of deodorant. And like, I shamed him for hours on the drive. I'm like, dude, you're not bringing deodorant on this hike. Like, we are all going to smell like shit. This is part of the experience. And I just ragged him long enough that he finally left it behind. And he was not regretful of not bringing it.
Yeah, I think that one is a safe one to make fun of people for. Yeah,
for sure. But there's got to be somebody out there that like needs their deodorant. Like, they've got a thing. Maybe they have extra stinky armpits or whatever it might be. Although no one has stinkier pits than me, Chon's gonna test.
Well, I think sometimes people just like to learn for themselves. So I think like you bring the deodorant and then you realize that you still smell like shit and then you feel at peace then leaving the deodorant because at least you learned for yourself that it actually didn't work.
Yeah, smelling like BO and Evergreen is just kind of a weird experience. Just like own what you are, which is stinky.
Neat.
Amen.
Yeah.
We're ready for your next chapter, Zach.
Okay. We have not been doing numbers, but for those keeping score at home, this is mistake number 7 that we witness. And yeah, this is me plugging my book, but not really. Cause like legitimately, this is the thing when I get people asking me like, if what's the Occam's razor approach to preparing for a through hike, I think it's, you have to mentally prepare for a through hike. And Chon, you touched on this a little bit with your friend who stayed with you.
We on the car ride home, we sat there and I was like, what do you think happened? And his answer was that he thinks he was physically prepared, but he wasn't mentally prepared.
And I got to give a pat on the back to that person because that's true in so many instances, but they will cite injury, budget, whatever it might be. Like, I think there's a lot of misattribution to that because people don't want to admit that they just weren't mentally ready or whatever it might be. But yeah, preparing, especially for a very long distance backpacking trip, but even something 500 miles is plenty long to have that feeling. Even honestly, even a weekend is long enough to where you have to at least want it to get to the end point. I think even if you get all of these other things wrong that we've said and that we will say, I think if you have the necessary mindset before embarking, you will find a way. And I think the proof to this is the fact that people have been through hiking. When was the first AT through hike? Like the 50s, 40s?
I would say the 40s.
Walking off the war again. Well, anyways, carrying the heaviest, like non-sophisticated, non-technical shit. Like you, without the trail being developed, no one knows what you're doing. There's no support system. There's no internet. There's none of this shit. And they're able to do it. Like if you want it bad enough, you're going to find a way to make this happen. So I doubt that Earl, what is his name? Why can't I think of it? Earl
Schaefer.
Schaefer. Thank you. I doubt that Earl Schaefer created lists before he set out on a thru hike. So you don't necessarily have to follow the practices or don't even follow the practices outlined in my book, but have a strong understanding for why you're going out doing the thing that you do so that when you do encounter these trials, should I keep plugging it?
I will say I'll plug it for Zach. Cause I read it actually after I'd hiked the PCT and I realized I, without knowing it, did some of the things in the book, and it definitely helped a lot to have that mental prep beforehand. And there were other things that I wish I had done that he pointed out. So,
okay, well, at least gets mental to keep prep. Her job for another week.
I'm also gonna go ahead and just
I'm a brown noser, it's fine.
I'll throw all of us under the bus quick and say that 5 people completed the AT in the 1930s.
Okay,
Myron Avery became the first 2000 miler in 1936.
I thought Schaefer was the first one to do it, and he was, quote, walking off the war. Was he walking off World War?
He wasn't through hiking, Myron Avery. Earl Schaefer was the first through hiker.
So to do it in sections.
Yeah, Myron Avery became the first 2,000 miler.
Okay, so.
But 5 people hiked the AT, or complete the AT, is what it says, in the 1930s.
Yeah.
3 people completed in the 1940s, 14 in the 50s, 37 in the 60s. You get the point.
Yeah. So it's tough for me to bring up this point without it just sounding like a shameless plug for my book. This is the thing that I wrote about after I thru hiked the AT with being quite possibly the biggest idiot on the planet. But I did dedicate a lot of my energy to discerning the reasons to why I was doing this. And like, I was in a bad place in my life. And I think going deep on the reasons that were motivating me to get on trail helped me in the days where I think other people would have likely thrown in the towel. Like it built a sense of resolute nature that regardless of what happened on trail, I was either going to finish or die trying. I think that's extreme. I don't think most people should have that stance. I think if you're going to harm your health, or, you know, you run out of money, or your personal life, or whatever it might be, there's obviously a ton of valid reasons to get off trail. They were just not going to apply to me. And a big part of the reason that that was true was because of the practices I did before getting onto the trail. And if you want a more eloquent take on why I think this is important, but also specifically how I prepared and utilizing the research that I did with self-help books. And this is not just in writing this book. Like, a lot of this was done when I was a teenager, big into like Tony Robbins and a lot of those style of books. Like, I apply a lot of the principles in those books to backpacking, and I think it's helpful.
Cool. My next one is not mentally prepping your family and friends.
nice.
I'm just kidding. My next one, so I think I'm going to save this one for an honorable mention because it's less of one, but I remembered one when I was talking about this weekend, which is not practicing communicating with your satellite communication device in different types of coverage, like tree cover, no tree cover, rain, no rain, before going on trail. And like, not
I have
just
some good stories to back
not
up
just
what
you're send
saying.
A message does a message send, but have a conversation. Because what happened this weekend was that I was getting messages saying, please come get me, please come get me, and I was sending messages saying, are you sure, are you sure, like, I don't want, you know, like, me trying to talk them back into it without, like, you know, forcing them back into it, and then them just being like, no, like, I'm sure, come get me, and me saying, okay, here's my ETA, it'll take me an hour and a half, I'll be there in this amount of time, like, and none of those messages were going through. So I was messaging their girlfriend, and their girlfriend was like, I told them like six times too, and I was like, I just keep getting these messages saying, just please tell me if you're coming or not, like, please tell me an ETA, and I was like, I keep sending one back. And when I got there, like, he didn't think anyone was coming. Like, he thought he was going to be stuck there all night. Like, he didn't think anyone was going to show up. And he just hadn't gotten any of my messages. And it was like, there was rain, there was cloud cover. And I think it's important to understand on both ends, hey, this isn't, you know, what looks like what? You know, what looks like someone's not responding at all? And what is the appropriate time for how long the delay is when messages come in? Like, if they haven't responded in 5 minutes, are they not answering me? Or is it like, hey, when I'm under rain, I know usually it takes 20 minutes for a message to come in. You know, knowing that stuff going into it can help you stay level-headed and calm if you're in a situation where you need to communicate using a satellite device.
Yeah. I've got some good stories. I'll just go with the most recent one. I have at least four of these, but sometimes you're almost better off. I'm never going to advocate for somebody not to carry a satellite communicator, but here's an example of where it can go wrong, is the backpacking trip that I did most recently last year. We did the Western Collegiate route, did part of it. Every single night I would send a message, and I thought it was just going out to Jenna, but apparently on this spot device, I hadn't actually cleared like the list of who it went to, so it was going to both my mom and my dad as well. And because of where we camped, I think it was the last night, it might have been the last two nights, we were just on the side of a mountain in dense tree coverage and clearly just didn't have access to a direct line of sight with the satellite. So it didn't go out. And they were used to getting that message. They knew I was out. And when I got home, when I got into cell service, you know, all the texts come in from my friends, my idiot dog shit friends, and then I get 1,000 text messages from my mom. It's like the last one I remember is like, you better fucking be dead. She was so mad that I wasn't updating her on my whereabouts that she would have rather me be dead because of all the stress that I put her through thinking that I was dead. And all the while I thought my messages were going out. I didn't get the red blinking light. There was no indication that nothing had gone through. Like, I legitimately left the communicator on for like an hour before I went to bed, which is more than enough time in 99% of instances. But yeah, that one specific time, I gave my mom like a panic attack and diarrhea.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
I've done something similar. I just got lazy charging my InReach, and I was doing the same thing, sending out, I'm at safe at camp text every night, and we were in the Sierra, and it was in 2019, there were huge earthquakes around the 4th of July. I think it was in that area. And apparently a bunch of people, I didn't feel it. I slept right through it. Back to the other stuff. I can sleep on a foam pad and I'm fine.
Through earthquakes.
Yeah. And so, but I mean, if you're familiar with the route, if you do Whitney, you might not leave for another, like, I think it's like 6 days. And so my mom this whole time is panicking, thinking I died in a rock slide in an earthquake. And I didn't even know an earthquake happened. So, yeah, make sure to text your mom if you tell her you're going to.
Or you can still tell your parents the exact duration to wait before hearing from you, and they might still not listen.
Right.
Like where we went through the 10-day stretch to Whitney, and I told my mom before I left Mammoth, it will be 11 days before you hear from me again. Not 10, 11. If you do not hear from me by 9 days, it is because it's not 11. If you do not hear from me by 10 days, it's because it's not 11. You will hear from me on the 11th day.
If I'm not back in 5 minutes, just wait longer.
I get to the top of Whitney and my phone has a ton of messages and I just open them. It's my mom. She's like, I called Zach. I can't find you. Where are you? I'm like, you call, how did you find his number? Like, how did you call Zach? Why would you call Zach?
What's he going to do?
Exactly. Of all people, that's who you call.
Yeah. No, I assured you that you were probably dead and, you know, yeah, start exactly. to make the funeral arrangements.
I was there the morning of the 11th as the sun was rising. It couldn't have been more prompt.
Yeah. Maybe the lesson there is that just like...
Moms will always worry.
Yeah.
That, maybe so if you want to learn about how to come...
Exactly.
Every time I take a photo on any sort of anything that resembles a ledge, my mom texts me or calls me. It's like, stop standing on the edge.
She's gonna
stop
kill me.
Doing oh, that.
She'll kill me for these two. But there have been two photos I've sent my mom that have been award-winning responses. One is I sent her a photo of Lake Tahoe from like one of the like hidden beaches. You know how they have those like rocks and the clear water. She replied, "Look at all the seals." But they were just the rocks in the water. And then the other one, I took a long exposure of the sky, so it had all the stars, and I sent that one to her, and she said, oh, my God, it's snowing. I was like, no, it's July. Yeah.
Moms are the best. That's the moral of the story.
Yeah.
Okay, I think this is our last mistake, at least for this one. I know I had plenty more. And based on how granular that your guys' were, kudos, by the way, I'm guessing we could probably do this for like another 4 hours, but we're going to wrap this particular episode up with this.
Is this me?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So this one is trying to keep up with people who are above your fitness level or maybe who even you just don't hike at the same pace as.
Guilty.
It's going to make you miserable. It's not fun for anyone. It's okay to just go your own pace. And a story that I'm going to tell is about my hiking partner, and he basically on day one of the PCT, I didn't know him yet, started going too fast, too early. He started like May 14th. So I think a lot of the people who started that day were already really well trained. They were ready to just knock out the desert. He doesn't train for anything, but is really fast. So he can keep up, but he's not necessarily in shape enough to do maybe a 20-mile day on the first day. So he gets to Hauser Creek, which is that first campsite. It's like 15 miles into the PCT, and no one else is stopping. So he decides he can't stop because that's lame, and he has to keep up with everybody who's going all the way to Lake Marina. And it's also a 5-mile climb into Lake Marina. So, and I think it was a really hot day, and so he's just like, fuck it, I'm going to do it. And I think 2 or 3 miles into the climb, ends up getting heat exhaustion, throws up, and is too tired to go anywhere and literally falls asleep on the trail. So he
that
wakes up.
That's a deceptively tough section. I remember thinking that, yeah.
He wakes up the next morning to a girl stepping over him to walk down the trail. And I guess she checked in on him to make sure he was okay and everything, but... moral of the story is even if you're fast and strong, if you haven't trained, maybe just, you know, take it easy the first day. Don't injure yourself at the beginning of a thru hike or any backpacking trip.
Yeah. As true on day one as it is week one or even month one. I think this is one of the things I see as a point of failure for people. I think I see this more in the AT, but that could just be like a exposure bias. But yeah, you meet people that you love, like you just resonate with them. And, you know, you think like, I'm going to hike all the way to Katahdin or I'm going to hike all the way to Washington with these people. And it just, if you're pushing yourself past your physical capabilities, you're going to get injured. And you're going to get off the trail. So like realize that there is a mighty downside to Elise's point of trying to push past your limit, and to a point that I made earlier, you don't know what you're capable of on a 3-day trip until you're at day three. Like, just because you can do something for one day, you cannot maintain that for multiple days. So like, if you're with people that look like they're fucking triathletes and like they're trying to do 2100 miles or 2600 miles in a 4-month span, and you're not there, like, probably start preparing yourself mentally that you're going to have to make new trail friends quickly, because like, it's just not possible to maintain that pace unless like you're a genetic freak.
Preach.
Yep.
Cool. Well, cool. That wraps our first, I guess not our first, but our first in a long time. Yeah. Non-traditional shows. We're actually going to just scrap the segments here because we're curious to get your feedback, how you guys like this type of a format. I know, super different than what we typically do. So email us podcast@thetrek.co, comment on the Instagram post of this episode. You could do
what's watch us on TikTok. E-talk.
Oh yeah, that's right. We're on TikTok. Leah, it's talk at Backpacker Radio. Yeah. What a good name. Let us know.
The only tick we're not fans of.
Maybe Jones is a dad too, because holy shit. Holy shit. Okay. Yeah, we're saving the rest of this stuff. I will say thank you to our Chuck Norris Award winners on Patreon. That is Jason Lawrence. That's a new name, right? Is it?
I think it got reordered, but there is a new name.
Okay.
I don't remember Jason Lawrence. You got that highlighted. But I also don't want to make him feel bad if
he's getting a lot of play right now. So Jason, do you guys ever watch the show? What was it with the Lawrence brothers? Whoa. Did I just date myself? Blossom. You guys never watch Blossom? Man.
Nope.
Anyway.
Definitely not Leo. Okay. Whoa. Somebody look that up. Jason Lawrence, Austin McDaniel, Andrew, Christopher Marshburn, S11N, Sawyer Products, Brad and Blair from 13 Adventures, Cameron Brown, and Patrick Chien.
This is definitely a new one.
I think it's Cianciolo or Cianciolo.
I like that. Yeah.
Cianciolo?
Either of those is better than what
but
I was.
But don't quote me.
Oh my God. Become a Chuck Norris Award winner on Patreon if you've got a confusing name, just so Zach has to read it.
Yeah.
But also,
but at least will bail me out.
I will say I liked when Andrew was before Austin McDaniel, because it always sounded like that was one person, like Andrew Austin McDaniel.
No, that's true. That's a great wrestler name.
It kind of freaks me out when their names are flipped. I liked them in that order.
Yeah.
We can fix that.
Patrick, if you're listening to this, let us know how to say your name so we don't continually fuck it up, or don't and laugh at our suffering.
Mm-hmm.
You can follow us on social at Backpacker Radio on Instagram, at Backpacker Pod on Twitter, facebook.com/backpacker radio. You can follow Elise
at Elise.ot on pretty much everything, or just search my name on like YouTube.
Or Chance.
You can find me on Instagram at Juliana_Chauncey. And most importantly, you can get my book, A Long Distance Hiking Guide for Family and Friends, on. No, I forgot the main title. Hiking from Home. A Long. Fuck.
She was so confident about it.
I was like, yes, I said it so smoothly. Get my book on Amazon.
That's it. It feels weird not having a longer end of the show, but we're going to do it. And you guys are going to let us know how you liked it. So thank you so much for listening, if you're still listening. And happy hiking.
Bye.
Elise, what's your sign off?
I can't follow Chance.
Okay, that's good.
If I want to bang it, I'm going to bang it. Not that I am banging it, but I could. And if it doesn't splatter to bits, I'm going to bang it later.